Hey guys, my guest today, Karen Conti, spent 7 months representing serial killer John Wayne Gacy. And boy, does she have a story to tell. Grab your popcorn and snacks, find a comfy spot, take a seat or lie down, and let me transport you to a place of fantasy, ghost stories, ancient legends, odd creatures, alien encounters, and other magical topics. You may even decide to join the conversation. From faraway lands to your own backyard, with a small dash of pixie dust, turn out the lights and open your minds. The journey is about to begin. Good afternoon, everybody. How's everybody doing? We are a few hours earlier today, so I want to welcome everybody who can be here. Otherwise, I'm welcoming everybody that's tuning in at 6:30 p.m. Pacific to watch the show. My name is Charlotte. I'm going to be your host for the next hour. I'm also the owner of the California Haunts Paranormal Investigation Team based out of Sacramento, California. We are 45 strong up and down the state, which means if you think you have a paranormal need or situation going on, we can help you. It might take us a while to get in is this huge state. A lot of people think of us like kind of like Hawaii with the surfer girls and all that stuff. We do have that. We do have that. But like I said, when you start going, you end up with farmland and deserts and high deserts and mountains and all that stuff. So it may take us a while to get to you. But in the case that it does, we do have mediums on staff who can phone you and talk to you about what may or may not be going on. And if it is deemed paranormal, they can sometimes settle the energy down before we get out there. And it usually doesn't take us more than one or two days to get out there. That being said, if you are watching from Facebook today, tonight, and a lot of you are, and you haven't done so already, if you like what you've seen here today, please feel free to hit that follow button. We're always looking for followers. And during the show, feel free to chat in the chat room amongst yourselves and leave us a thumbs up. Leave us a thumbs up or one of these happy heart things or, you know, a happy face or whatever. Because what that does is that puts us up in what they call the FYP, which is the For You page section. And the master computers see that and they distribute this out to a lot more people during the show. Okay? During every show. Every viewing. Same thing goes for YouTube. If you haven't subscribed to the show yet, there's more than 950 videos sitting over there. They're all of this show. And I think you'll be entertained because it's like today. I'm a journalist, photojournalist, and I don't like to do paranormal stuff constantly. So I like to change it up to do news items. And so I will do shows like this. I will do shows on spousal abuse, all kinds of topics. And what I've done is, since there's so many shows over there, I've taken and put them into different files and categories so you can find them easier. If you're into Medium Nancy Matz, you can just click on her folder. If you're into cryptids, you can click on that folder, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Same rules apply. Like I said, subscribe if you like what you see, and leave us a thumbs up over there. Please leave us a thumbs up over there. Show us some love, okay? And chat in the chat room amongst yourselves, and I'll try and answer your questions as much as I can. Also, Twitch, we're going to be Twitch and TikTok today, so TikTok, be sure to double tap that screen, and over at Twitch, same rules go for Facebook and YouTube, all right? So, yeah. Now that we got that out of the way, you can see my ticker at the bottom. You know, we've been looking to get our bills paid this month, and we got a very generous donation from Michelle last night, and I want to thank her, but we're still $60 short of that goal that we have. So, you know, you guys aren't required, but it would be nice if you did, because, you know, California Haunts, the Paranormal Investigation Team does operate as a nonprofit, so that means so does the show. And so we survive off donations, and I'd really appreciate it. Keep us on the air. I have bills coming up due in the next few days, and that would be great if you could donate. You could do that at paypal.me/California Haunts, or you could do that at Venmo and or just Venmo and then type in California Haunts. But I'd really appreciate it. But you're not required to. We're all one big happy family here. I'm excited. A lot of you guys don't realize this, I was a newspaper reporter editor for years, and my specialty was crime and courts, and I spent a lot of time covering murderers, you know, covering, I'm going to say unalivers, I don't know if you say murderers, but covering murders, and I actually got the opportunity to, go into the county jail and interview a few over the years. But none like this gentleman that we're going to be talking about tonight, John Wayne Gacy. When I first started this show back on Blog Talk Radio, I got the opportunity to interview Mr. Gacy's first attorney. When Mr. Gacy was first arrested and being investigated, and the police were at his house, looking under the floorboards and doing all that stuff, this gentleman, I was like a family attorney, and that's the only one that Mr. Gacy knew, and so he called him in to handle things on scene, and he had a very, very interesting story to tell. He's now deceased. When I came across Karen's name, I was just so fascinated by her book. I was looking at excerpts of her book, and it's a look at a serial killer on death row, and it's a fascinating book. And for a brand new attorney, and I'll let her tell her story, but I think you're going to enjoy tonight's show. So let me bring her in, and off we go. Hello.
Hi, Charlotte. How are you?
Good, welcome. I'm so excited to have you on.
I'm excited to be here.
Little bit about you.
Well, I've been practicing law for 37 years. I have my own radio show on a station in Chicago. I do a lot of legal analysis for on a variety of legal topics for television, local and national. I've been a law professor for about 25 years, and I have my own practice in Chicago. And I just so happened to have represented serial killer John Wayne Gacy in his final death row appeals.
Absolutely fascinating. And my understanding is at the time you were a new attorney.
I was because, Gacy's crimes were being committed in the 70s, and he was arrested in 1978. At that time, I was in high school, a senior. So, I remember being in the Chicago area, watching the bodies being brought out and being horrified, not really even understanding the nature of what Gacy did. And, he was the boogeyman growing up. So now, 14 years later, Gacy's been on death row, he's been convicted. I've gone to college, I went to law school, and I'm a rookie lawyer, and I get the strange call that would kind of change my life.
I want to apologize really quick about the internet. There's a lot of news going on out there. I don't know what's going on in New York, but a lot of people are online, trying to get the news and stuff. So everybody in this neighborhood has Xfinity. So when we're all on together, this happens where we drop off like Mario, So just bear with us tonight. What was it like the first time you walked in there? Because I know my first, I used to watch that silly show on HBO Oz. And I remember when they asked me for the first time that I had to walk into the county jail to interview a murderer, how it was kind of unnerving to walk in. Because the inmates can see you through plexiglass or whatever. You're walking down there's always a line to follow to get into that interview room. What was it like for you to go in that first time?
Well, I'd been to prisons before, and they're not nice places. And Menard Correctional Center, which is 6.5 hours south of Chicago, is just an old, old building sitting on the Mississippi River. It looks like something out of a Stephen King novel. But you go through all these this labyrinth of prison cells, and you've got inmates catcalling and saying all kinds of stuff, and finally you get to death row, right? And I thought, like in the movies, I would be behind a plexiglass window, right? And Gacy would be on one side, I would be on the other. Not so much. What I didn't understand was when you were on death row, the guards would put you into this bullpen, slam the door shut, and were able to watch you among all of the people on death row. So it wasn't just Gacy, it was all the people on death row who had visitors that day. And some of these people were really bad dudes. I mean, Gacy was a bad dude, but he was at least controlled in his killing. Some of these others were psychotic from what I knew about them. So Gacy, I wasn't really afraid of, wasn't his type. And I knew he was measured, and I know he needed something from me. But the other inmates, I think I had a little bit more fear about.
Now, to be the open. That would bug me. I mean, I got to do the thing like TV. It was plexiglass. I had the glass between us with the phone, to interview these guys, and that was still unnerving enough. But when you're in the presence of somebody like Gacy, what was it? I mean, his demeanor. What was it like the first time you met him?
Well, you know, it's surreal. It's like with anybody whose face you know from magazines and the news and the horror, you know. But Gacy was so unintimidating. He was so unassuming. He was 5'9". You know, he was very charming. He was glib. He liked to talk. He was gracious. There was nothing about him that you thought to yourself, there is the evil guy that I've been growing up with. Mm-hmm. You know, you somehow think there's going to be a tell that I'm going to be able to see something about him that really opens the door to what he was capable of. But there just wasn't. And that's why he got away with it.
Sure he did. I was just thinking that as you were saying that, because I know, like I said, in my experience interviewing these types of guys, they're very charming. And so you can understand how people got drawn in to them, into their web, if you want to say the spider or the fly.
Otherwise, he would have been one and done. You know, he blended into society. And, you know, when you get to know about Gacy, he was a guy who, you know, he was living in a nice suburb. He had a very successful business. He had a couple wives and raised children. He, you know, did charity work. He went to church every week. He mowed the lawns for his neighbors. This was a guy who lived a very upstanding life, except for the fact that he would go out at night and troll for young men and boys, torture them, sodomize them, and kill them. You know, it was such a strange thing to look at somebody who was living this normal life, talking about normal things, knowing that they're capable of things that I can't even imagine, to tell you the truth.
Did he ever talk about his crimes to you? Or was it just all, you know, like you say, he was real charming and stuff?
Well, the gentleman you interviewed before, Sam Amaranti, his first lawyer, who was a friend of mine, Gacy confessed to him. He confessed in great detail. He could recount a lot of the names. He could recount where he picked up the young men. He actually drew a map of where the bodies were buried in his crawl space. But thereafter, Gacy just decided that he never confessed. He didn't kill any of them except the first one, and that was self-defense. So he was basically in denial by the time I met with him. And no matter how much I tried to get him to talk to me with the idea that maybe I could try to save his life if I had some information that I could use with the prosecution, being very doubtful about that, but still, he refused to admit that he did it. And he said the only thing he was guilty of was running a cemetery without a license, which was his brand of humor.
Wow. Did he, was he able to grasp, you know, the weight of what was going on, the fact that he was going to be executed for what he did, or was it just something he just blocked out and just went his happy way with all this?
You know, that's a good question. And I think it's the latter. He was in denial his whole life about who he was. I think he denied his sexuality, and that was not unusual back in the days where he grew up. It wasn't, it wasn't something that was acceptable back then. I believe that he denied the part of him that was murderous and a sadist. I believe that he did that in such a good way that when it came time for him to face his execution, he was in denial about that too. And I think as much as I tried to talk to him about it, because that was my job as a lawyer, to prepare him for what was going to happen and to see if he had any legal needs that he needed to have taken care of, he just really refused to even talk to me about the fact that his life was going to be extinguished very soon.
Interesting. I just find this fascinating because, you know, you read stories about people like Ted Bundy, you know, and all this, as they get closer to that death day, you know, how they react and how it seems like they're calm, that they just stay calm about it. Did you ever get the impression that he was giving you a snow job at all, you know, as far as trying to charm you in and pull you in?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, because I knew what a sociopath was, because I had read a lot of his psychiatric reports, I had read all the books about Gacy. I've always been like a serial killer student, right? So even when I was a kid, I was talking about Lizzie Borden with my dad, as sick as that is, and Jack the Ripper, and who really was the culprit there. So I had a good knowledge of what I was dealing with. And, when you're a sociopath, everybody is a pawn. Everybody in your life in front of you is there to do something to help you get what you want. So I knew that. And what Gacy would do with people, and I watched him, and he was a master. I don't even think he thought about it. I think it was instinctive. He would gather information from you. He'd ask you where you're from. He'd ask you what you thought about this. He'd ask you about your parents or whatever it was. And then at some other point, he'd pull that information out and he'd either use it to make you feel guilty, you know, use it to kind of like get back at you and kind of spar with you. And I watched him do it with everybody around him. And, you know, to some extent it works, but when you're prepared for it, you have a little bit more of a defense and you can kind of counter that while it's going on.
Now you described, you know, what it was like to meet him, you know, in this communal thing. I mean, it was rather communal, the space that you met him. Were you able to take a look at his cell and then see what was on the walls and things like that?
Actually, I wasn't, because where you visit is, you know, you get escorted there. So I wasn't. I mean, I've seen pictures of his cell. I mean, it's like half a parking spot. So it's pretty dismal. And in this particular prison, people have died of exposure for the cold, and people have died of heat because there's no air conditioning. So it's quite a bad place to be. And it's very dangerous, especially death row, because you've got a lot of people who are psychotic, unmedicated, and have nothing left to lose, which is a really bad combination.
Absolutely. How many guards were in there with you guys when you would sit with him?
None.
Wow.
No, the guards were on the other side of the locked door.
Wow.
And while they were there to protect, right? Yeah. I don't know. You know, some of the guards to me looked like they would have loved to see something go on there. And you know what? Mm-hmm. My guess is they wouldn't have rushed in to help us. Mm-hmm. So that was disturbing, because they're, you know, if you get to know prison guards, some of them are, you know, they're a little scary themselves sometimes.
Yeah, they're hardened. They're hardened.
They have to be.
Was he wearing any kind of chains or anything, or was he just walking around free like anybody else?
He had handcuffs on, and he had shackles, loose shackles on his feet. But he was able to walk, and he was able to, you know, carry things. And again, you know, that sounds like you're safe, but you know, handcuffs can be a weapon as well. So.
Right.
It was something that I was concerned about. Not so much with Gacy, but with the other inmates who were there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know about, you know, attorney-client privilege and all that, but can you give us an idea of the types of conversations that you had with him?
Yeah, I mean, I can talk about things that aren't legal related, and clearly we had a lot of them. I mean, I spent over 50 hours with him. And one of the things that I did with him was to develop a relationship where I could talk to him in a way that wasn't just legal. And as a woman, I was his only lawyer in 14 years who was a female, which is kind of interesting. And what I realized and surprised me was that he really liked women. He loved his mother. He had two sisters whom he loved greatly. He got along with me a lot better than with the men. The men, he was kind of oppositional, and he was defiant and aggressive. But with me, he was a little softer. He would talk to me about gardening and cooking. We had some laughs together. And the purpose of me trying to get him in that kind of friendly mode is because he could be difficult to deal with. And when it came time to strategize and to have him sign off on some of the positions we were taking and he didn't want to accept, I was better able to do that with him because of our relationship and our sense of humor that went back and forth. So as much as he was a manipulator, Charlotte, I was pretty good at manipulating him back.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So, you know, you were trying to find something, you know, to help him, you know, to keep him from being executed. As the day neared and the time neared for his execution, did his demeanor change at all?
It did not. At all. And, you know, I had to talk to him about that, because if the law says that if a person on death row becomes psychotic or upset, which a lot of people do, because you know, you're going to die at a time certain, which has to be, you know, pretty frightening for the average human being. If that person goes south, then you can delay the execution. So I was constantly weighing in with him to make sure that he was all there. And he was completely, and he would have none of it when I said, "Are you sure you're okay?" And even as to the last day that I said goodbye to him, he thought it was like he was throwing a party and he was the host of honor. You know, he had his family in there. He had friends from 14 years back who loved him unconditionally. He was enjoying his last meal. He was laughing with people. It would be like just something out of a cocktail party, except the cocktail that was being served was a lethal one.
Which brings me to ask, and I don't know if this is client privilege or whatever, but the family, I mean, were there the friends, did they believe what he did, or was it something that they just refused to believe?
Well, his sister, who I developed a very nice relationship with, said that she called Gacy when he was in the lockup, when he got arrested, because the brother that she knew could never have done anything like this. She said, I refuse. He was generous. He was kind. He was loving. He was honest. And she said, the only reason that I believe he did those things, I said to him, John, did you commit these crimes? And he said, yes. Mm-hmm. And she said, okay, I still love you. And she loved him to the end, like all of his family did, like all of his friends did. He had friends at the end who unconditionally loved him, knowing darn well exactly what he did, which to me is astounding.
Now, I interviewed Bill Kimmerlin the other night, and he's done a lot of research on death row and whatnot. And he's got inmates that are sending him gifts, you know, like paintings and stuff. Did you ever get that from Gacy? Did he ever gift you with anything?
He sure did. I have three of the ugliest paintings you will ever see in your life. He gave them to me for my birthday, and I really just don't know what to do with them. You know, I don't want to sell them and make mm-hmm. money on it. I don't obviously want to hang them up, but they're kind of sitting in my closet right now.
What? Can you tell me what they are of, or you can't tell what they're of?
One of them is a skull clown. Where okay. You've probably seen it online. It's a skull with a clown's hat on it. It's really horrible. Mm-hmm. And then one is Pogo the clown, and that's him waving in his clown getup. And then he did one that he said it was for me and me alone. It was like a seascape. Again, kind of purple blue seascape. Again, pretty awful.
Everything's a clown.
Ooh. He loved his clown stuff. And I talk about that in my book about,
yes.
I think that clown thing was to kind of hide and mask that mm-hmm. darkness. Also, I think he thought he could be somebody else around mm-hmm. children when he was in that clown getup, but you know, he never abducted anyone while he was doing that. A lot of people think that's mm-hmm. how he got children to come with
right.
him. But
right.
you know, I don't think anyone would go with someone who look like that.
Now, in your book, you talk about having lunch there or eating a meal there. Can you describe that?
Yeah, well, I'm kind of a healthy eater, and the food in a prison is usually pretty bad. But it was interesting. The first time I was there, all of a sudden, my partner and I got served a lunch tray. And I said to Gacy, I said, John, that's really nice. I mean, I'm getting served, like the state can't be buying me lunch, can they? He says, no. What happens is when you have a guest on death row, one of the other death row inmates who doesn't have a guest will give up their lunch, and then I will reciprocate next time they have mm-hmm. a guest. Mm-hmm. I said, oh, wow, that's really nice, John. I said, who gave up their meal? And he said, Charles Albanese. And if you're in Illinois, you know who Charles Albanese is. He poisoned his entire family with 2 pounds of arsenic. So that was Gacy's joke of the day.
Bet you were picking at that meal.
That's right. I was moving things around, you know.
I would have been honestly sore on a diet right now. I just can't deal with it. I can't eat this. I'm sorry. I was thinking, you know, when you were talking about walking in, you know, to the area to meet with him, and I was thinking, you know, people have this thing, you know, from watching TV, like with me with Oz, you know, going in, you know, and it's a sober feeling, and that's what people don't realize how sober it is when you hear those doors close behind you.
That's a really good point, and I tried to capture that in my book, because I mm-hmm. I really kind of try to put myself back in that time. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's sad. And why is it sad? Because you walk into a prison and you realize that probably the vast majority of people at this prison looked at the outside of that prison and will never see the outside again, ever. Mm-hmm. And second of all, what happened to these people where they are so damaged that they caused and inflicted so much violence and pain on people that they can't walk mm-hmm. amongst us ever again? Mm-hmm. That there's mm-hmm. something so sobering as you, that's a great word. And sad about that. Again, like, mm-hmm. I'm not saying let them out. I'm right, not right. saying that. The Gacy's of the world belong in there, right? They cannot mm-hmm. walk among us. But it's mm-hmm. but there's something sad about it. Like, what tortured them? Like, what did their family do? Mm-hmm. What did society do? Was it poverty? Was it neglect? Was it abuse? you know, or was it just something organic? You just want to figure it out because it's so very sad.
And then going back to TV, I think a lot of people, like you were talking about them leering at you and making noises and stuff. It comes to mind, Silence of the Lambs, when Jodie Foster was walking through that insane asylum and those guys were making these noises at her. It makes you feel really self-conscious when you're walking through.
It does. And, you know, I actually have been compared to her, which is kind of interesting. But I think that, you know, you understand that kind of thing. I mean, these men are starved for, you know, a woman, you know, not in a prison guard outfit, you know, and, you know, I just take it in stride. It's just, you know, that to me is just par for the course. But, you know, a personal assault, you know, that would be something different. But again, Gacy was kind of protective of me while I was in there. And the inmates, even though a lot of them were psychotic, I think they understood, if they didn't understand anything else, they understood that we were there to try to save Gacy's life. And if we could save Gacy's life and make arguments that resonated with the courts, they may be saved as well. Again, spoiler alert, I did nothing to save John Gacy's life, but I think they knew that we had value to them, so they weren't going to do anything to affect that.
Well, I mean, you know, along that line, like you say, they didn't do anything of value to affect that. Was it because he had come to terms with the fact that this is what was going to happen to him, so he was just going to let it take place without a fight?
No, I mean, he was fighting. Well, he was actively involved in the appeal process and had his own say about certain things. He wanted to live. You know, I talked to him about that. And he said he never wanted to get out of prison, which was interesting. And I asked him why. And he said because he's safer in prison than he would have been on the outside, which I took to be a lie. And I really thought that what he was telling me, reading between the lines, is that when he was arrested, Sam Amirante, his lawyer, really talks about how he was relieved. Not that he felt guilt about what he did, but it was becoming so difficult to maintain this lifestyle where he was going out and working and being a family man and killing and then hiding things. And he was so stressed out that it was a relief that he didn't have to do that anymore. Again, no remorse, but just, I think he preferred to live a life where he didn't have that kind of anxiety.
Makes sense, because I remember The Deliberate Stranger with Ted Bundy, when he asked about where he was most likely to be executed. And then he turned around and committed murder there. It was in Florida. And because I think he was at the point like that where he was just tired of that, you know, that lifestyle and having to live like that.
I mean, you can imagine, you know, you anticipate being caught. And in Gacy's case, he was taking drugs to stay up at night to do these things. He was taking drugs to stay up during the day. You know, he was drinking, you know, it was just, you know, it was out of control. And he needed more and more of this horrible sex stuff to feed his urges. And it just kept feeding, you know, at one after another. So I do believe there was relief there when he was caught.
I can imagine, because it must have been really difficult, like you say, to do that. And plus, your mother's in the house, you know, you're trying to hide this stuff. And so it's a constant game of cat and mouse to keep stuff away from her. And these smells are coming up from the basement. You're trying to explain, you know, no, Mom, it's not that. It's something else, you know, that's going on. So that's got to take a toll. It's got to take a toll.
A lot of balls in the air, to use a clown analogy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Do you think that, you know, towards the end, he... You know, even though he didn't really admit to it that he did feel some sort of loss with his life, you know, at the point that maybe, you know, I could have gone a different direction or anything like that, or was he just a complete sociopath with it all?
I just never saw that self-reflective side, you know, and because I say in my book, like, what is going through his head when he's got that lethal injection getting ready to kill him. Like, is he thinking, I'm going to meet my maker? Does he believe in God? Does he believe in an afterlife? Is he remorseful? Does he say, darn, I wish I didn't have this hobby. I could be outside, you know, doing what I love to do. You know, is he thinking that he's the victim? I would guess that he thought of himself as the victim. And he would say things like that all the time, that that he felt like he was the 34th victim, is how he phrased it. So, but that's very typical of a narcissist or an antisocial person, they don't feel like what they did was wrong. They feel right. like they're the one who is being targeted and mm-hmm. and was done wrong, which is just so bizarre, but that's the way they think.
Now, as you say, there were other death row inmates in the room with you. Did any of them walk towards you guys or anything else like that when we were, you know, sitting with him, or were they pretty good about just giving space?
I spoke with a lot of them, had some interesting conversations with people who ate body parts and did all kinds of horrible things. There was one particular inmate who was the youngest death row inmate in Illinois history who killed his entire family because they were getting on his case about playing a loud stereo. And he barged into our cubicle at one point looking for matches. At the time you could smoke, and he was psychotic. He had what I call those Manson eyes, right? Those just uh-huh. vacant eyes, like uh-huh. there's nothing there. And Gacy had to stand up and get him to back away. And I thought to myself, I can't believe I'm feeling protected by a man who killed 33 boys.
Wow. I can imagine. My house that I live in currently is only 4 or 5 blocks from where Richard Trent and Chase lived.
Mm.
And so that was a big deal. My dad, like your dad, my dad loved that stuff. And one time he was a marshal, and so we would have these conversations about these murderers, Lizzie Borden and all this stuff. So I grew up doing that. That's why, when they offered me the spot as a crime reporter, it was like a natural thing to say, okay, I can do this. This isn't a problem, you know. And just reading all these cases, especially I have studied Gacy a lot. You know, and what he did, how he committed the stuff. And like I said, Mr. Amirati, you know, talking with him. Did you ever in your wildest dreams, as you were going through law school, think you were going to be counsel for him?
Oh, my gosh. No, I mean, you know, I was so naive. I mean, it was a different generation there. I think young people now, like, they're online, they see stuff that, you know, I didn't even understand what it meant to be a pedophile. I don't think I really grasped that. Mm-hmm. And certainly when I was in law school, although I enjoyed my criminal law classes, I never thought I'd represent anyone who was guilty. Mm-hmm. You know, I just thought that I would always be standing up for the underdog and helping people in any way I could. But, you know, I did remember my lecture on the insanity defense. I remembered my lectures on capital punishment. I was always very interested in capital punishment. I was always against it. Even when I was a young child, my parents were in favor of it. I was always against it. I'd fight with them about it. But, you know, I never had any inkling that I could ever be in a situation where I would ever represent a John Wayne Gacy.
Well, let's go back a little bit. When they told you, assigned the case to you, because probably somebody assigned the case to you, correct?
Yeah, it was a little different. It was weird. Okay. So my law partner and I had argued before the U.S. Supreme Court about 6 months before we got the call. And it was a First Amendment issue. And so Gacy was being sued by the prison because they didn't like the fact that he was making money on his paintings. And in Illinois, you can sue an inmate who's making money to pay for the incarceration. So that's what they did. And Gacy wanted to defend it. And so we were on a short list of First Amendment lawyers, and that's how we got the call. Now, I sit there and I say, this guy's going to be executed in 7 months if the state has its way. Why are you worried about money? Like, how stupid is that? But see, that was Gacy. He would divert everyone's attention to things that didn't matter so that the light wouldn't be shining on what really did matter. But mm-hmm. when I got that call, I said to my partner, we have to go down there. I'm not going to represent him for free in something stupid like this, but I have to look evil in the eye. How could I say no to that, right? I'm not committed. I want to see him. I want to meet him. I want to see what that's like. And that's how we did it. But, you know, when we got down there, you know, it was all fun and games. But then I realized they're going to execute not just him. They're going to execute all these people on death row. And I have an opportunity to do something about it. And that's when I said to Gacy, let us represent you. We'll take care of this civil matter, take care of it, get it settled or whatever we need to do. But I want to be on the death team. I want to stand up against the death penalty. And that's how we got involved.
And I think there's a little bit like, you know, with me, you know, you come out of your first meeting and your reaction, you're up here. You know, you come out and you say, hey, I just interviewed John Wayne Gacy. Or I just interviewed, you know, I just talked with so-and-so. But that does wear off after a while as you get to know him.
Yeah, it just normalizes, you know, and a lot of people don't understand this, but I have had a lot of clients who are less likable than John Gacy. You know, and just because a person does evil things like Gacy doesn't mean he walks around acting like a monster, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, to some extent, he was kind of fun to be around because he was so funny. Again, it's hard for me to say that because I don't want people to think that I somehow think that what Gacy did was funny, because it's
right,
not
exactly
funny at all. But when you have to get along with somebody, you know, you find something in common with them. And I have a lot of people. I represent people who beat their wives. I represent people who embezzle money from their churches. I represent companies that, you know, poison the water. You know, I represent a lot of people whose behavior I do not condone, but I have to get along with them. I have to empathize with them. I'm not a good lawyer if I can't do that. So I did that with Gacy, and it really wasn't that hard, to tell you the truth.
Well, I know from experience, you know, being around people that have mental issues, that they're very good actors. You know, they can act like there's nothing wrong with them at all. It's kind of like when your dad goes to work, puts his suit on, goes to the office, that's his persona at work. Then he comes home, and that's what these guys do. They're able to switch personas like that.
Absolutely, and it's done in a way that is not conscious. I mean, they do it instinctively, and you know, he just wasn't. I mean, and you could see the cracks sometimes, because he would say something derogatory about gay people. Then he would say, "Yeah, but you know, men should be able to have sex with whoever they want." And so he would be all over the board because he didn't have like a consistent, you know, core. Like, if I got to know you, Charlotte, I would kind of know how you would react to something. I would think, oh, I know how she feels about this. I think she's going to be angry about that, or she's going to. But with Gacy, you just never knew who you were getting, because he was a bunch of different people. I'm not saying he was schizophrenic, but he was definitely had some different roles in his life that he would play. He'd play like protective dad. He would play hardcore businessman. He'd play, you know, playful, you know, jokester. And, you know, then he also had the serial killer persona.
I was just thinking while you were talking too, is, you know, most prisons, if a man has hurt a woman or hurt a child, the other prisoners don't like it. And so was he ever, to your knowledge, was he ever in fear of any of the other prisoners on death row or in Gen Pop, when he was on Gen Pop, that they might hurt him?
Well, he was hurt by a guy named Henry Brisbane, who was psychotic. He was the I-57 killer. He was a brutal killer and rapist. He was attacked by that guy. They ended up being friends afterwards. I think that Gacy was protected because he was making money. And I'm not saying a lot of money, but he was selling his paintings. And he would use that money to wield influence. So if you have money for cigarettes or money for commissary food, Gacy would do that, and he would buy protection. So I don't think Gacy was really afraid of the other inmates, because he was kind of put on a pedestal in a way, because he was the worst of the worst. But again, these are very unsafe places. You know, like I said, the people are psychotic. They walk around on a day-to-day basis, and you just can't predict what they're going to do.
The last day that you saw him, because I know, is it like it is on TV where the attorneys can go in and watch the execution?
No, we were not allowed to do that. In Illinois, even the victims' families were not able to do it. There was a lottery system of all things, and people would vie to sit and watch the actual live event, if you will. I wanted to be there. I thought to myself, you know, lawyers are entitled to be with the defendant during interrogations, during trial, appeals, et cetera. Why not at the very most important part of it, end of a death penalty case, which is the execution? But that wasn't allowed. And so I had to say my goodbyes to him before. And, you know, the execution was, you know, it was botched. So it took a long time for them to kill him. But even the family members, like I said, didn't get to watch it live.
Were there any particular last words that he had, or something that he said to you, you know, before you were leaving that stays in your mind?
Well, a few things. He said, he gave me a hug. He took each of his lawyers by themselves and spoke to them privately. And he said, I think your career is going to soar. Your obituary is going to read Karen Conti represented serial killer John Wayne Gacy. He said that I'm going to always be tied to him no matter what I do. And, you know, he and I shared a little practical joke that we were going to play after Gacy died. And we talked about that. And he told me he loved me. You know, I don't think he meant any of it, but that's what he said. He was actually very gracious. And the part about my career soaring afterwards was kind of prophetic, because it really did, interestingly.
Mm-hmm. And after that talk, how long was it before he was executed?
Probably a few hours.
Wow. Do you remember what his last meal was?
I sure do. It was Kentucky Fried Chicken, fresh strawberries, French fried shrimp, Diet Coke. Hmm. And it was particularly creepy because Gacy was incarcerated in Iowa before he started his crime spree in Chicago. And he was arrested and convicted of trying to sodomize a young man who worked for him while he was a manager at a Kentucky Fried Chicken. Wow. So I thought that was kind of an odd choice of food. Mm-hmm. Although Kentucky Fried Chicken is pretty damn good.
Mm-hmm. So how many people do you estimate were there that last day?
Who were visiting him?
Yeah.
It felt like about 40. You know, that was my memory. It was just crowds of people who came in there. There were lawyers who had represented him in the past. Like I said, neighbors, relatives, friends, pen pals that he made along the way. People from his church, just a group of people, random people who really unconditionally loved him, which really shocked me. I mean, again, it's not that I should have been shocked, but they still loved him, even though they hadn't really dealt with him in 14 years and they knew what he did. So it was just kind of confusing, actually.
Mm-hmm. When you first met with him, how did he treat you? Well, like you say, you know, he talked to you nicely and stuff, but did you get the impression that he was sizing you up?
Oh, for sure. And I think when he realized that I was going to be personal with him, that he welcomed that. And I think that he was, like I said before, defensive with men. And that is probably because his father was very abusive to him and beat him and berated him and called him all kinds of, you know, anti-gay type things. And so he was very protective of himself when it came to men. But like I said, he loved women. And so once I showed the side of him that I would joke with him or be, you know, attentive to his needs, because I'm an empathetic person and I'm a woman and I, you know, was kind enough to, you know, tend to his needs a little bit more than maybe the men, I think he trusted me. I think he really, really trusted me. And that was hard with somebody like that, because they, you know, sociopaths are, you know, they're always on the defensive. I think of them as animals, you know, they're predators, but they're protective of their territory and protective of their space, because they know what predators really can do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How old was he at this time?
I believe he was 54. I think I'm right about that.
How long were you able to spend time with him on each visit?
He insisted that we get there early as we could, which is, I think, was 10 o'clock. And then we would leave at 4, which was the end of visiting hours. So, you know, when you're on death row and, you know, you've been in prisons before, they welcome visitors. They have nothing to do all day long. They're locked up in a cell. And this is like their favorite thing in the world, is to talk to anybody. So we would spend like the whole day there with him. We would buy him vending candy bars and things like that, because he couldn't buy them himself. We'd have to bring quarters, and we'd, you know, buy him his Milky Way and Diet Cokes and all of that. And even if we didn't have legal business to talk about, we'd end up staying there until the end of the visiting hours.
Did he ever say that he regretted, or show, like you say, they don't show regret very often, but when he would reference his mother or anything like that, did he ever show any kind of remorse for the fact that he wasn't there to be with his mother, or she couldn't be with him?
There was one time where we were talking, it was during the Christmas holidays, and Gacy was in prison in Iowa. I told you about that prior conviction. And his father died when he was there. And he always wanted to make his father proud. And his father was proud of him when he had those jobs at the Kentucky Fried Chickens. He was, you know, making really good money, living a nice life. He was married with children, living a respectable life. And then this happened. And so he went to prison and his father died. And he really felt guilty about that. I think if there was any guilt that I ever saw him feel, he did talk about how when he died, the father died, he wanted to go to the funeral, but they wouldn't let him, and that he regretted that, and he really did think that that his incarceration caused his father to have a heart attack and die.
Wow. And I don't want I don't want to purdy this up, because the man was a horrible, deep down he was a horrible individual from what he did. But is there a memory that you can tell us about that or there's like a fond memory that you have of him?
I have quite a few of them. I mean, he was engaging, and a quick story is that I am a big practical joker, and I like to throw parties for people, surprise parties in particular. And I used to throw surprise parties for my partner, and they were so crazy that they made the national news. I, rented out a courtroom, and I had him arrested by the Chicago police and brought to trial. I had him taken by ambulance to a medical facility that I had rented out for the night. So, I mean, I've had these wild parties. And so Gacy asked me, knowing about the parties, what am I going to do this year? And I said, John, you're going to be dead. So like, why do you even care? He goes, no, I'm coming to that party, Karen. So he's scheduled to be executed in May. My partner's birthday was in October. And I said, no, John, the idea of you being out of jail, and invited are nil, so we kid about it. So we concocted a plan that Gacy would leave a goodbye message to my partner on my answering machine, and that if Gacy were executed on May 10th, which he was, I would wait the 5 months to October and play it on the answering machine so that my partner would wake up and hear Gacy's voice from the grave. And so that was one of my fondest memories, because that was one of the last things he said to me. He said, now, Karen, don't forget to play that tape for Greg.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah,
that is funny. That's just brought to mind like these stories you see occasionally on Facebook where somebody has died, and they have a recorder inside the coffin, and people are walking by, and the guy will say, "I'm still here," and there'll be a tapping noise.
Gallows humor. You gotta love it, right?
Yeah, I love it. Was he able? I don't know how it works in Illinois, because I know California has two or three forms of execution that they could choose how they want to be executed. Did he have a choice at all?
No, he didn't. When he was sentenced, the method was electric chair. But by the time his case wound its way through the courts, Illinois had just used the lethal injection machine, and there was no choice. Okay. It's interesting, because the lethal injection machine, at least the one that we have in Illinois, had in Illinois, was, and also in a lot of states, was invented by someone who was neither a doctor nor an engineer. And so this thing malfunctions like all the time. Mm-hmm. And that was one of our points of appeal, saying, we can execute people in this country. There's no question about it, but it's cruel and unusual to suffocate them to death. And this is what happens, the line clogs and what have you. And again, a lot of people said, well, who cares? Gacy got off easy compared to the boys. I understand that. I appreciate that argument, but if we're going to live in a civilized society, it seems to me that we should do it as quickly and effectively as we can and not torture people. But that was one of our arguments.
When you talked about the machine malfunctioning, was it because I've heard stories about, like, sometimes they can't find a decent vein to do it, or maybe they miscalculated the inmate's weight, on doing it. Was there ever a definitive statement about why there was such a hard time with him?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think it was finding the vein, but that's a common one, because when you're cold, your veins restrict. A lot of these inmates have drug issues, and so that they have compromised veins. I don't think those issues were there with Gacy. I think it just clogs. And, when you have people doing injections who aren't medical doctors or nurses, because they can't participate due to their oath that they take to do no harm, you have these wardens and you have these guards doing these, like, they're amateur-like injections. And the lines clog all the time. This is just what happens. It's not a machine that gets invented, like, by some, patented company or something. So right. It's just an amateur way to kill somebody, and it's going to malfunction. It happens all the time.
Now, when you were leaving, from your last meeting with him, Did everybody else leave, or was it just you guys that left, or did everybody go at once?
We left before everyone else because we wanted to let Gacy, you know, mingle with his family and friends and you know, mm-hmm. having his lawyers there. I mean, we were there. We had to be there to tell him that the Supreme Court had denied his last appeal, and that was left mm-hmm. to me. I was the one who had to give him that news. And so once that was done, we just decided, you know, let him enjoy his family, friends. We're no longer needed here, and we left.
I get the impression talking with you that, you know, he was not going to say good, but he was what's the word? You know, he was okay with what was about to happen, you know, to him. With the appeals, did he really want the, I mean, to be perfectly honest, because I mean, or was he just sick of the way things were going and he was just willing to let it happen?
I mean, no, he fought to the end. He did fight to the end. I mean, he didn't tell us to stop the appeals by any mm-hmm, means. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And when I told him the bad news, you know, he asked me some questions. He said, was it unanimous? I told him, no, there was one Justice Blackmun dissented, and we made a joke. He said, well, make sure you send him a thank you note for me. And, you know, and that was that. So, no, he was fighting, but he just did not have the appearance of somebody who knew that he was going to die at a time certain. He, mm-hmm. I mean, listen, if I knew that, you know, in 2 hours to the minute, someone was going to put a needle in my vein and I was going to be dead, mm-hmm. I wouldn't be calm. I'd be, you know, sweating. I'd be vomiting. I'd be, you know, but Gacy, again, denial. Maybe that mm-hmm. was, maybe that tool finally worked for him at the end.
Mm-hmm. And how did you feel? You know, after that last goodbye, you turn around to walk away from him. How are you feeling at that point?
Yeah, I was shockingly choked up. I did mm-hmm. not expect, I mean, I was nervous the whole time, you know, because I'm like, this is serious. He's, you know, he's going to be executed on my watch. You know, how's this going to go? Is, you know, are we going to have a reprieve, and then are we going to be back here next week? And I mean, I was just nervous as anything. But when I said my goodbyes to him, it was so confusing, Charlotte, because, you know, you want to call the authorities. Someone's going to be killed. I'm going to call up and try to get it to stop. But, you know, the authorities are the ones who are doing it. And it's then I saw all those family members go in who are sobbing and carrying on. And you know what? When you know somebody, and you see a human side of somebody, even someone who is guilty of inhumane acts like Gacy was, you still don't want someone to die. You just don't. Mm-hmm. It's just mm-hmm. a human nature. I mean, Gacy obviously didn't have that, but I do. And I did. Mm-hmm. And I felt like we are going to take away a life. He's not harming anyone. He's in this prison. It's a, it's, you know what it is. That place is a horrible place. Mm-hmm. And I just felt how wrong it was to do that. So I was choked up.
Do you have any advice for, you know, any attorneys that might be in your situation that are going to, you know, have to do this?
Well, I will tell you this. We abolished the death penalty in Illinois, no thanks to mm-hmm. anything I did. But I will tell you that taking on an important matter that has ramifications, and again, I want to emphasize that I was representing Gacy, but I was also representing the cause against capital punishment, because I thought to myself that if I could make any arguments that got any traction that would help Gacy, they would also help the other inmates on death row who may be actually innocent, which mm-hmm. after Gacy was executed, we had 12 men walk off of death row, actual innocents. Or, you know, incompetent counsel or racist right. prosecution, you know, they all of those things. Gacy had none of those arguments. But I knew that I was arguing important matters to important courts to set mm-hmm. a precedent. And I will tell lawyers who are out there, are young people who are going to law school or thinking of a career doing work, pro bono work or doing legal aid work, you know, take on things that are tough. Take on things that may rub people the wrong way. It was hard, but I will tell you that it was a pivotal point in my life. And that's why I wrote this book, because mm-hmm. I want to tell you that my curiosity, just to go down there, was the number one thing. But the number two thing is I became resilient. Mm-hmm. I became resilient to people saying bad things about me. For bomb threats, death threats, you know, sexual threats. I I can't, I became a little bit more articulate talking in front of people. My career was better, and I'm a better person having represented John Wayne Gacy, as strange as that sounds.
And how long after his death did you start to write the book?
30 years.
Wow.
You know, 28, really. And by the time it was published, it was 30. And it just took a while for me to pick it up because it was such a traumatic time, you know, stressful. And I, you know, I lost all my clients and I donated $250,000 to a cause that I didn't help, you know, and it was just hard. And I also wanted to give the victim's family a rest. I didn't want to put out a book and have people think I'm trying to profit on that. But I really, during COVID, I really, you know, I got a call from a Netflix affiliate who wanted to do a docuseries on my story with Gacy. And I said, you know, I'm not going to let someone tell my story. I'm going to tell my story. And if someone wants to make a movie about it, let them do it. But I need to get the story out. And so that's during COVID, I sat down and I wrote my book.
That's my next question was, how long did it take you to write it?
You know, not very long. I want to say it was about 5 months. I enjoy the process. I write for a living. As a lawyer, you write quite a bit. But this was different because I had to be reflective and I had to go back and imagine who I was back then and then kind of figure out how I got to who I am now. And it's really was cathartic and it was creative. And I was amused by it. I was kind of looking out of body experience at that young lawyer who, you know, changed and had a metamorphosis. And I really enjoyed the process.
So following this case, like you say, your law career took off, obviously, you know, to where you are now. After his death, you know, after it happened, how long did it take for that change to occur? Was it instantaneous? Because obviously people, you know, were able to connect you with him.
Yeah, it's interesting. When he died, even though the people that hated him hated me because I was representing him. After he died, there was like a sigh of relief. And then people were like, oh, you want to come speak at my engagement? Do you want to talk about this? I mean, we want to fly you here to talk about the death penalty. So the other thing that's interesting is 30 days after Gacy was executed, O.J. Simpson took his drive in the White Bronco in your neck of the woods. And so because the media knew who I was and I'd been commenting, I was a member of the California Bar. I got called upon by MSNBC and Fox News and CNN to do legal commentary. And that kind of sprouted my career as a legal analyst and then, allowed me to have a radio show on WGN, which I've had radio shows for at least 30 years since Gacy. So those good things happened because of my media attention because of Gacy.
I know this is an offbeat question, but have you ever gone to see his grave at all?
No, I don't know where it is. And the family doesn't talk about it. It could be that there is no grave.
That's possible, yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. How can people find you?
Oh, you can find me on my website. It's karenconti.com, KarenConti. You can sign up. I have like virtual book clubs and all kinds of stuff I'm doing and podcasts like yours. And, you know, you can always email me at hello@karenconti.com. I would love for you to buy my book. And again, my book is about Gacy, but it's more about, you know, just a career and about how this is a pivotal time and how you can change and take something bad that happens to you and make it into something good. And I hope that people enjoy the book, get something from it, and email me and let me know what you think. I would love to hear from you.
What's next for you?
I'm going to write a fiction book.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. And I started. Now I just need to find some time to do it.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
I enjoyed it immensely. I would love to have you on again sometime.
Anytime you want. I can weigh in on serial killers or anything you like.
Sounds great to me. All right. Well, thank you very much and have a great rest of your evening because it's evening where you're at or it's coming up on evening.
It is.
So I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great one. All right. I just love it. I could talk to her all day. I could pick her brain, serial killers, all that stuff all day. Like I said, I kind of grew up on that with my dad. Tomorrow, we're back on our usual schedule, 6:30 p.m. Pacific. Going to be our old friend, Lon Strickler. He's going to be talking about various cryptids. Mothman, you name it, We're going to cover it tomorrow because he's got. He also has some new information that he's gotten in different cases that he's investigated fairly recently about them. All right, I want to thank everybody for coming today. I realize this is the afternoon, and for you guys coming on to watch this thing tonight after you get off work, I hope you enjoyed the show as much as I did. If you'd like the show, share it with 5 people. If you hated the show, share it with 5 of your enemies. We are equal opportunity here. We're just trying to get the word out about our little old show, and I've been saying this just about every night now. Our numbers have gone up. We are growing. We're growing fairly quickly, and I'm real excited about that, really excited about that. But I want to say how much I appreciate each and every one of you. I appreciate the donations that came in this week. And like I said, we're still around $60 short. So if anybody could help us out, that would be great. You know, paypal.me, California Haunts, or Venmo, California Haunts. I don't like to beg. I normally don't beg, you know, say this. But, I mean, yeah, I just want to keep things going, keep us on the air, and keep bringing you quality guests like Karen. Okay? But anyway, I will see you guys tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. Pacific. I hope you have a great evening. And have a good one. Bye.